This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today's guest, Nels Klein, is best known as a guitarist in the indie rock band Wilco. He brought a more experimental sound to the band, adding the kind of feedback, distortion, and noise that he's explored in the avant-garde groups he's led. But as you can hear, the album he released last year is a departure. It's a collection of lushly arranged versions of American popular songs, covers of more recent songs, and some original compositions. The album is called Lovers, with arrangements by Michael Leonhardt. In 2007, Rolling Stone named Nels Klein one of 20 new guitar gods. And in 2011, he made the magazine's list of the 100 greatest guitarists of all time. We're going to listen back to the interview Terry recorded last year with Nels Klein, shortly after his album Lovers came out. This weekend, Nels Klein will be performing at the Solid Sound Festival, a three-day music, comedy, and arts festival curated by Wilco on the campus of Mass MoCA in Western Massachusetts.
Nels Klein, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe the concept of your new album, Lovers.
Well, it's something I've been pondering and dreaming about for, well, maybe over 25 years, certainly. It's about a mood music record, but not a cheesy one. It's an attempt to show feelings, update, and be more thorough. The idea of romance, sexuality, intimacy, and how that relates to songs. Not to say that I have achieved that, but I am aspiring to that.
So you said it's kind of like your take on mood music, but not the cheesy kind. In my mind, mood music was always considered cheesy. it's not about just, you know, to me, like beautiful music, you could say ballads. But mood music always implied this kind of cheesy thing for swinging bachelors or for, like, there's always, like, a picture on the album cover of, like, a beautiful woman and lying in front of the fire or a woman lying on with her head on her lover's lap or something, you know, and supposed to, like, put it on to get in the mood. And
right.
So that's the cheesy part. Why are you thinking of it in terms of mood music? Why not just come out and say they're beautiful ballads?
Well, I think it has something to do with how I initially thought of the record, because I was working for almost 10 years in a record store in West Los Angeles called Rhino Records, and we had all those $1 mood music records, many of which I put up on the bathroom wall for the covers that you're describing. But I also discovered later that some of them weren't cheesy, and I also felt that it would be interesting to update the idea of this record and make it darker in terms of the emotional and artistic content.
So you're best known for more like free jazz kind of stuff and for adding distortion and feedback and noise to Wilco with your guitar and all the gizmos or whatever that you have that you can attach to it. And in this, like, you're playing on a lot of it much more straightforwardly and much more melodically. And I'm wondering if melody is starting to take on new meaning for you as a musician.
Well, I mean, I think it's always been there. But maybe you're correct in that there is a, I guess, continued interest that has taken on new meaning and maybe a certain kind of relevance as I have hit age 60.
The age when melody sets in.
But it's always been there, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I just feel that in my own work, there have been, I guess, more extremes. But every one of my records pretty much has some kind of at least floaty ballad on it that I consider to be melodic, but they might be at least a little abstract.
I think one of my favorite tracks on here is Beautiful Love, which is a Victor Young song. And he wrote some great songs, My Foolish Heart, When I Fall in Love, Street of Dreams, I Don't Stand a Ghost of a Chance with You. And the theme for Johnny Guitar, which is which Peggy Lee sings in the movie and is really great.
Wow, I forgot about that.
Yeah, and this is not one of his, you know, best known songs, but it's a beautiful song. So tell us why you chose it. And I'd also like you to describe the instrumentation we're going to hear in the opening, because it's very ear-catching, and I recognize some of the instruments, but I don't know exactly what's going on.
Well, we've got a reference at the beginning of Beautiful Love to its original appearance, as far as I understand it, which is in the Boris Karloff movie, The Mummy. And in that iteration, it's in 3/4 time, which our introduction is. And I asked Kenny Wollison, who plays vibraphone on this, to put the motor on very fast, which is a sound I associate with the 1930s and 40s, and a sound that one does not hear so much these days. It was kind of, I guess, deemed uncool at some point. I don't know what happened there. And we've got the bassoon, and we've got flute, and it's just very charming at the beginning, and then we go into what I could, I guess, generally describe as a jazz guitar bass drums trio with Devin Hoff and my brother Alex Klein. So it's a kind of combination in my mind of a retro tribute and then an update relating to my love of jazz music.
Well, let's hear it. It's a great track. It's called Beautiful Love. And this is from, I guess, Nels Klein's new album, Lovers. Love from Nels Klein's new album, Lovers. What you're playing there in your more solo part sounds almost inspired by Wes Montgomery.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, many great jazz guitarists I could name. I have to say that Jim Hall is a huge inspiration and a touchstone for much of this record for me. And Jim and I were sort of getting to know each other not long before he passed away. And while I was making this record, there were certain pieces that I really couldn't wait to play for him. But he passed away in the last day of tracking in his sleep in his apartment a block from where I've been living in Manhattan. And Secret Love on the record is actually an homage to him directly, because we play it in the key of A flat major that he enjoyed playing it in, and I always thought that the polyrhythmic heartbeat polychord that I came up with would really, really kind of bring a smile to his face. But certainly Wes, I love George Benson, and I think that Django Reinhardt, when he went electric in the 50s, is very underrated, and I really love that sound. So certain aspects of guitar are part of the sort of layered homage on much of this record.
You know, you mentioned Jim Hall, and I think of him as being one of the most spare guitarists. And I think of you as just a kind of multi-layered, very almost dense guitarist, because there's so many layers of sound and distortion in some of your work. So it's interesting to me that you would feel such a connection to his music.
Jim was a genius, and he was also, yes, as you point out, really a master of understatement. And I think maybe in this case, my deep love of him is not merely aesthetic and musical, but also there's that kind of love of the other, you know, because yes, I have a million notes buzzing in my head. And when you hear Lady Gabor on the Lover's record, you hear me doing live looping and all these kinds of things that I enjoy doing that are, I guess, part of my style, I guess, you know, I don't know. But I do aspire to growing up someday to being more like Jim. I wish.
So let's talk about your work with Wilco. I know there's a lot of Wilco fans in our audience. You joined the band in 2004. So what did Wilco bring out in your playing? Like, how did you adjust yourself to find the right sound for Wilco?
It's actually kind of interesting that I think primarily my goal was not to bring my personality as a whatever, you know, jazz type, soundscape type person to the band, but that kind of ended up happening. I feel that mostly it the Wilco songbook kind of brought out my sort of 14-year-old aesthetic self, the rock and roll obsessive that was listening ardently to Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds and, you know, the Beatles and Rolling Stones, that music that I grew up with. And interestingly, I think trying to channel either my initial idol, Jimi Hendrix, or trying to fake some Clarence White or, you know what I mean, some great Glen Campbell stuff or something. And then Jeff has to tell me sometimes, you know, you're being too reverent to this material. And sometimes I think he wants me to destroy the song, as he did on a song like Dawned on Me, where I think I was trying to come up with some little jingle jangly thing. And while I was messing around, I was strangulating my 60s guitar and with an amp that was basically, I blew up the amp doing this. And he said, that's the sound that should be in the solo section. So, I mean, that would not have been my first impulse. And I think that people think it is that my whole raison d'etre is to bring some sort of chaotic sound design to Wilco's ensemble sound, but it wasn't. I really enjoy addressing this more classicist aspect of popular music, whether it's country, folk, or rock and roll, and just trying to make the song sound like the song should sound. You know what I mean? It's not all about some kind of avant-garde mindset or about changing the sound of the band or bringing whatever my thing is into it, because I really don't think I have a thing when it comes to music. I think I want the music to sound like it should sound to everyone in the band, and then particularly to Jeff if he wrote the song. That's what's successful to me.
Did you have to find not only like a music space for yourself within the band Wilco, but also like an on-stage personality to have? Because let's face it, the smaller, more avant-garde groups that you play with probably play in like small clubs and small performance spaces where everybody's wearing a t-shirt. And granted, you all wear t-shirts on stage anyways, but you know
not
what I mean?
Me.
Oh, not you. But those small spaces, I mean, it's just different than being in like a really big theater or an arena.
It's sort of, this is going to sound maybe a little like I'm kind of not telling the truth, but I am telling the truth. I don't really care how many people are there, and I kind of play the same no matter what. But yes, rock and roll has pageantry, I like to call it.
Yeah, exactly.
In Wilco, yeah, we have lights, we have atmosphere, we have, you know, fake smoke, all that stuff that rock
bands
do. You
do the fake smoke thing?
Well, light designers insist on it, so they get definition from the way the lights look. It's just a thing. We don't do like fog, like dry ice fog, like The Cure or something. But you know, I was playing rock and roll with Mike Watt and in the 90s with the Geraldine Fibbers. And when I play rock and roll, I move around a lot. And I just do, you know. And when I play with Julian Lage, I'm sitting down, you know. I just like to do all these different things. And my concentration and my, I have to say, my dedication to the moment and to the sound is the same no matter what I'm doing. And I think without sounding disingenuous, I get a kind of fundamental, if not moronic, pleasure from sound as soon as it starts. So even in sound checks, once we start playing, I'm in the zone, I'm happy. You know, because I like playing and I like sound and I like all different kinds of sounds. And that is what drives me. And that's what's probably saved me.
So when you're soloing, is there a time limit on your solo? Like, especially for recordings, you know, does Jeff Tweedy say, okay, like no more than 35 seconds?
Well, the song form is usually kind of set except on Art of Almost from the record, The Whole Love, where he basically created a coda that we played separately and edited on to the end of the song. So I would, as he put it, shred. So he asked me to shred, and I think that the length of that was determined prior to my shredding, but it could have been longer or shorter if I'd wanted it to be. You know, other songs, like, you know, I just mentioned Dawned on Me, that solo section, which is just shrill noise at this point on the recording, is of a set length. And I find that this is a huge challenge for me. I start thinking about people like George Harrison when I'm given this little space of maybe 10 seconds or 15 seconds to do something, you know, beautiful, coherent, exciting, whatever is required, because I am not good at self-editing. So it's a really, really a great challenge, and it varies from song to song.
Well, why don't we hear the song that you were referring to, Dawned on Me. So this is Wilco with my guest Nels Klein on guitar.
Every night is a test.
That's Wilco with my guest Nels Klein on guitar. You said, as you know, that Jeff Tweedy uses the word shred to describe your playing. And it sounded to me like you were distancing yourself from using that word yourself. So do you object to the use of the word shredding to describe yours or anyone else's guitar solos?
No, but I have to say that what he was asking me to do is play some really exciting, crazy guitar. And that's not normally what is required on most Wilco songs. So that was why he used that word. And I'm comfortable with it, but I'll use it really with a little tongue in the cheek usually. But it does sort of set the scene, doesn't it?
Right, yes, right. So you started playing guitar when you were 12, and your twin brother, Alex, I think started playing drums at about the same time. So that must have been pretty great to have a twin brother who you could play with.
Absolutely amazing, because not only did we do everything together, including obsess about rock and roll and then later jazz and improvised music, but he was always really good. So I always had this really amazing drummer to play with. And then without getting all mystical and weird, there is a kind of a psychic thing with twins, which I can't deny. And so there was this kind of communication that is absolutely unique and really kind of a seamless kind of like bonding consciousness that I experienced playing with him for really up until into my 30s, I guess. And we stopped playing together a lot because I was on another path. And he's a very serious retiring kind of person and never endeavored to make a living playing music. So he plays all the time in Southern California or on the West Coast, but works at UCLA in the oral history program.
But he plays on your new album.
Yeah, he was the only person I ever wanted on this project from the very beginning. And it's because of his, he has a lot of big band experience from all his playing in high school and beyond. And it's his use of colors, his ability to use symbols in a certain way, his ability to phrase to keep the band really together, and his feel and sound, like everything about it. I just knew he was the guy. And so far, you know, I flew him and his family out to New York to make the record, and we performed some of the music at the Newport Jazz Festival several weeks ago, and I could fly him out for that. And so far, I've been able to have Alex on this music every time we try it.
Are you identical twins?
Yeah, we're actually a type of identical twin called mirror twins.
What does that mean?
From what I understand, it is a type of twin where the egg separates at a very, very late stage in development, and he's right-handed, I'm left-handed. We're opposite personalities to a great extent. His hair parts naturally on an opposite side from mine. We're called mirror twins because if you come up behind me and I'm looking at myself in the mirror, I look like my brother and vice versa.
Wow, that's really, I didn't know there was such a phenomenon.
Yeah, it's weird.
So did that ever make you feel like you were half a person when you weren't together?
No, but people would make you feel like that, you know, like when you're a kid, they say like, where's your other half? So my brother and I spent a lot of energy differentiating ourselves from each other and asserting our individuality in the world, I think, so that we would be seen as individuals and not one part of a two-unit whole, you know?
So what did you do to differentiate yourself from your brother?
Well, it's actually humorous probably to think about it, but for example, music, since we're talking about music, we liked all the same music for the most part, but there are certain bands that were, there were my bands and there are other bands that were his bands. And even though we listened to everything at the same time together, for example, you know, Frank Zappa, the Mothers of Invention, that was an obsession of my brother's. Well, he was always going to be the Zappa guy, or he was always going to be the Jethro Tull guy, or, I mean, he tormented me with Black Sabbath at the time, but, and rarely did we switch over. So, for example, like he loved the Grateful Dead when they were psychedelic, and then when Working Man's Dead came out, I loved that, and I became the Grateful Dead listener. That was a rare event. You know, the same thing happened with Joni Mitchell, where I was listening to Joni Mitchell, and then when she started playing the Hegira era stuff with Jaco Pastorius and whatnot, he became obsessed with that music. And I said, hey, man, it's a great record, but go for it. You know, you can have the Joni records now.
So you're mirroring with your taste in the Grateful Dead and Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, that was the only sort of crossover from the sovereign record universe that we lived in. But you know, I mean, I didn't love everything Alex listened to, and you know, I tortured him with Johnny Winter and Live, and he tortured me with Blue Cheer. But we still sat and listened to this music together all the time and talked about it, and that was one way. The other way was, of course, clothing. We didn't dress alike, but it was an amazing and magical connection, you know. And I know that it's frustrating when people can't tell you apart and you think you look completely different from this other guy. But that's just a tiny irritant in what is really a kind of really special and marvelous existence.
So how did you dress to set yourself apart from your brother? And is that reflected in how you dress on stage today?
Interestingly, Alex was a very flamboyant dresser in terms of color when he was really young. And then when puberty hit, he started dressing really drably. My brother now he's been a vegetarian for most of his entire adult life, as far as I recall, and now vegan. And he's kind of one of these kind of hemp pants and croc wearing kind of people. And I think my initial look was based more on kind of drab hippie stuff. Like in the school, I was wearing a lot of denim work shirts and football jerseys to imitate my idol Leon Russell, you know. And I don't dress much like that anymore, although it would probably work really well with Wilco. But I went into a whole polyester thrift store phase, you know, and started wearing really outlandish clothes, especially with the Geraldine Fibbers, where I was encouraged to do this. And they had, Carla Bozulich had such an amazing sense of style. And
Wait, does. Are we talking those like 70s and 80s wide lapel polyester suits?
Didn't have any suits, but I did have some crazy shirts. My favorite crazy pants at that time were what I called my Gumby pants, which I had bought in, I believe, Cincinnati. And they were low-rise bell bottoms, green bell bottoms with really, really wide. They were elephant bells, I guess you'd call them. And I would wear these with a women's pajama top and a big, wide red vinyl belt and work boots.
Wow, what a combo.
Yeah, I was really skinny then too, Terry. I mean, it's things.
But you still are.
Sort of. Well, no, not like I was though. My brother and I were alarmingly thin, and it was not cool. It was sort of the object of ridicule, you know.
So, how did you first discover jazz? Because when you were growing up, jazz was no longer the popular music of its time, and you had to find it.
It's a pretty cool story, actually, Terry. My brother, as I mentioned before, was really into the Mothers of Invention and Captain Beefheart and some of the more forward-looking artists of those days. And a friend of ours, who's no longer on the planet, named David Hirschman, was asked to buy for his father, Jack Hirschman, who's the very avant-garde and renowned poet from the San Francisco area these days. He was asked to buy John Coltrane's Greatest Years Volume 1 for his dad's birthday. His dad just said, "Here's what I want, go get it for me." And when David heard it, he loaned it to Alex, my brother, saying, "I think you might like this record. It's reminded me of some of that instrumental Frank Zappa stuff you like." So I'm still not sure why we were in our friend Bill Watts' apartment at the time without him or anyone else in his family being there. But we were sitting in his apartment in West Los Angeles and put on Africa, which is an edited version on that record. And that was the moment that I decided that I needed to know everything about what had been happening with so-called jazz music. And I became a Coltrane obsessive. And also, the piece on that record, After the Rain and Alabama, are utterly profound and changed my whole way of thinking about music.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. This is a real pleasure. You dragged some things out of me that I'm kind of surprised I got to talk about, and it's really, really cool. Thank you.
Guitarist Nels Klein speaking to Terry Gross last year.